Well, on the slide, you can see the title is Megillat Esther. A Megillah is a scroll, and there are five books in the Bible. They're called the five Megillot, the five scrolls. Esther is one, and Ruth, and you have Song of Solomon, Lamentations, and Ecclesiastes. And these are read at specified times throughout the year. For example, at Shavuot, Pentecost, we read the book of Ruth. And we read the other books at certain times. Well, when it comes to Purim, we read the scroll of Esther, Megillat, the scroll of Esther. I wasn't planning on kind of doing a run-through of what Esther's about, hoping that everybody has read it, but Robin says you probably should go ahead and do a quick overview of the book. Because if you're not familiar with Esther, a lot of this might go right over your head. So we don't want that to happen. So here's a quick outline. In chapter 1, we are inundated with details of King Ahasuerus' palace. He's the king of Persia. Describes the decorations, the materials, the floor coverings, the utensils, the wine, the numbers of people. It's just, we're inundated with details. He's having this enormous banquet that goes on for days and days. At one point, he commands the queen, Vashti, to come and appear before his guest in a way in which no woman should ever have to appear before a guest. She refuses. He has her killed. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2. He has the world's most famous beauty contest to find Vashti's replacement. And Mordecai, a Jew, encourages his beautiful cousin Esther to apply. She wins the contest. She becomes the next queen. Also, during this chapter, Mordecai, who works at the palace, he uncovers a plot to kill the king. He exposes the plot and saves the king's life. End of chapter 2. Chapter 3, we're introduced to the villain, Haman. I knew somebody would do that. We're introduced to the villain. Now, there's an important thing here. Haman, in every respect, is a picture of Satan. He's a picture of the dynamics of our spiritual enemy. But what I love here is that before the villain even appears in the story, God has put Mordecai in place, and he's put Esther in place, because these two individuals are the keys to saving the Jewish people in this book. So he establishes the cure before he brings the disease. He brings the solution before he presents the problem. And this is the way God always works. This is why the word says of our Messiah that he was crucified from the foundation of the world. In other words, before Adam and Eve were even created, God's solution to their sin was already in place. Isn't that great to know? This book will, I hope that by the time we finish our study, you'll have a whole new appreciation for God's sovereignty. So in chapter 3, Haman is introduced. Haman hates Mordecai, and therefore he hates all Jews, and he comes up with a plot to have all the Jews destroyed. Chapter 4. The Jews learned of Haman's evil decree. Haman took dice, or lots, pur, what they're called, purim is plural, and he cast these lots aside what date he would have all the Jews wiped out. In chapter 4, the Jews, their reaction is recorded, and then Mordecai tells Esther, Esther, you're in the palace, you're the queen, you've got to go talk to the king to get this canceled. She says, if I go to the king unannounced, uninvited, I could be killed. He says, well, if you don't go, you're going to be killed. She said, good point, so she went to the king. Chapter 5. Esther decides to go before the king. She does. She's accepted, and she invites him and Haman to a big banquet at her place. And Haman is so thrilled and so full of himself, he's been invited to dine with the king and the queen. He says, I'm just going to really move ahead with my plot to have Mordecai killed. And he has this gallows, this enormous tall gallows built to hang Mordecai on. Chapter 6. In chapter 6, the king can't sleep. He has the historical records brought forth. One of the attendants begins to read to put him to sleep. And it happens to be the part where Mordecai exposed the plot to have the king killed. And then the king says, did we ever do anything to reward Mordecai? And the guy says, no. And he says, We need to do something. What should we do? Is anybody in the palace I could ask? And the guy says, Haman's here. Bring Haman in. Haman, what would you do for somebody that if you were the king, what would you do for somebody you really wanted to honor? Haman thought the king was talking about himself. He said, put him on the best horse. Put him in the king's robe. You know, just really deck him out and have him paraded through the streets and proclaim that this is what happens to someone the king blesses and approves of. King says, that's a great idea. Go do that for Mordecai. And he does. And Haman is totally humiliated. Chapter 7. Esther invites the king and Haman to a second banquet. And at this second banquet at her house, the whole plot to destroy the Jewish people, including herself, is exposed. And at that point, the king decides he's had enough of Haman. And he hangs Haman on the gallows that Haman had built for Mordecai. And then in chapter 8, we have the battle where the Jews are now given permission to defend themselves and to fight for their lives. They have the battle. And in chapter 9, they have the victory and not one Jewish life is lost. Chapter 10, happily ever after. That's the story. And you'll experience that in music tomorrow night. Now, this book of Esther is a very odd book in the scriptures because God's name is never mentioned in the book. Never mentioned. And it seems like the book is really about the enemy and how the enemy works. But you see these things that look like coincidence taking place. You see God hidden. You see extraordinary physical detail in this book that you don't normally see in any of the other books of the Bible. In this book, it looks like everything's just by chance, because even Purim means lots, like you just cast the lots and see what happens. But like it says in Proverbs 16:33, the lot is cast into the lap, but it's every decision is from the Lord. And so what looks to us like just chance, just looks to us like laws of nature, like evolution and Newtonian physics and just chance. God says, don't be deceived. I'm all over this. I'm the one that makes the world run. In fact, we'll look at some numerical values of words. This is something that's done often in the Hebrew. Every letter has a numerical value. And the number for God, Elohim, is 86. 86. But the Hebrew word for nature, Hateva, is also 86, because God hides himself. Isaiah in chapter 45 says, thou art a God who hides himself, and he does. And he hides, he puts on a mask. In fact, the word Esther itself means hidden. Sitar is hidden. So everything's hidden. Everything is behind this mask of the physical. Everything's behind the mask of just chance, just the laws of nature, just coincidence. But all through here, God's hand is all over this. And what we're going to do with this study is we're going to look into the Hebrew itself. I always say Hebrew is the key to the scriptures, and I stand by that. Without Hebrew, there are certain rooms of the Bible that just remain locked. But with Hebrew, the treasures can be seen. It unlocks the doors, and we can see the treasures that are there. Now, Haman was a descendant of Amalek. And God had commanded Moses and Joshua to destroy Amalek. And Amalek comes on the scene way back in the Torah in Exodus chapter 17. And I don't know why there's a dash before the 8, but what had happened is that the people had been going through the wilderness, and they kept kind of complaining and whining. And God had provided water from the rock, manna from heaven, splitting of the seas, and all these things God had supernaturally provided. They could even look up and see the fire at night and the cloud by day. And then when they reached the point where the Jewish nation asked, is Adonai in our midst or not? It's like something God snapped. You know, he doesn't snap. But it's like they had crossed a line that was so vile that immediately he sent an enemy called Amalek. And he says in Exodus that they were to erase the name of Amalek from under the heavens, and they'll battle Amalek every generation forever and ever. I mean, so which is it? You erase them or you battle them all the time? And this is a picture of something that takes place in us. We are always battling Amalek to erase his name, to erase his memory. Because Amalek in Hebraic thought is always synonymous with doubt. With doubt. Physical appetites, living the animal life, and doubting that God exists. Is God with us in our midst or not? King Saul had the opportunity to bring Amalek's line to an end. You know the story. He was to fight Amalek. He captured the king. And then Samuel comes on the scene and he realizes the king has not been slain. And during this time in which Saul held the king of Amalek, he produced a son. And then the king was slain, but the seed had continued on, and a descendant of that king is Haman. So, Haman is first mentioned in Genesis 3:11 in the garden. When Adam and Eve had eaten of the tree from which God told them not to eat, he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat?" That phrase "from the tree" is Haman Ha'etz, and there's Haman's name. And what's weird is that it should only be spelled Mem Nun. You don't need the hay there. For God ordained that when Genesis was written, hundreds and hundreds of years before Haman was born, that he would have Haman's name connected to the first sin. When people indulged their own physical appetites, when people doubted God's word, and then Haman appears right there. Something else that's kind of interesting, this word ha'etz. Etz is the word for tree. The last two letters of the second word, that's the word for tree, etz. And when you read through the book of Esther, Haman builds the gallows for Mordecai, to hang Mordecai on. But there's not really a word for gallows. It's etz gavoa, a tall tree. You see, in Hebrew, the word for tree, the word for wood is the same thing. So here, when Haman, the name that would become Haman, first appears, Haman Ha'etz, from the tree, we find later Haman builds an Etz Gavoa on which to destroy Mordecai. But turns out he himself is destroyed on it. The first appearance of Haman is connected to a tree. And when Haman finally is dealt with, it's by a tree. And there's a connection here. And I wish we had time to go into it. I'd love to develop this more, but I'll leave that to you. I always like to give some homework. Another thing about Haman. When he made this decree against the Jews, it says in Esther 3:13, letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instructions to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate. I'm not quite sure what the difference is between those two. To kill and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. But what does that remind you of? When Yeshua describes Satan and his activities, what does he say? He says he comes not but to steal, to kill, and destroy. Now, you know, Yeshua knew the book of Esther inside and out. He'd heard it read every year on the Feast of Purim. And you're going to see another thing in the book of Esther that influenced, apparently, what Yeshua would teach. Because Yeshua's teachings were based upon the scriptures, the Hebrew scriptures. Another interesting thing about the book of Esther is that it begins, the very first letter of the very first word is the letter Vav. The very last letter of the very last letter of the book, or the last word of the book, is also a Vav. Go back to sleep, Rob. I got it covered. I'm just kidding. No, is there something showing up at the bottom here? No, okay, all right. That's the first time he's ever told me I'm good. Thank you. That's my wife doesn't even say that. Okay, now. Oh, I'm getting, see, this is what happens with comments. I'm getting, digging myself into a hole. I'm getting in big trouble now. Oh, these looks I'm getting from Robin. Okay. Okay. She's going to unleash the flying monkeys any moment. That's going to be bad. All right. Now, the book of Esther has an even number of verses, 176 verses. Okay? So on this side, we have 88 verses. On this side, we have 88 verses. So the first letter of the 89th verse, smack in the middle of the book, is also a Vav. The letter Vav is the sixth letter of the alphabet. It has a numerical value of 6. So the middle, the beginning, the middle, and the end of the book, you get this. Now, maybe it's just coincidence, but I don't think anything in the scriptures is coincidence, because the book of Esther is a picture of how our enemy operates. And this thing comes to a culmination when we see the Antichrist, the anti-Messiah, come on the scene later on. And just like Hitler, who tried to destroy the Jews, that was just a little forerunner of the one who's going to come later, who will try this again. Don't think for a moment that the Holocaust is a one-time event. You know, it almost happened back in the book of Esther. There are a number of times it has occurred to some degree or another. And then in our parents' generation, World War II, Hitler almost succeeded in wiping out the Jewish people. And there will be one final, last, grand attempt to do it again. The question is that the believing Gentiles who claim to love Israel, to love God and his people, will we stand with the people of God or not next time around? But in Revelation 13:18, it refers to the Antichrist. It says, this calls for wisdom. Let the one who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. Now, I said that God's name does not appear in the book. But in the Hebrew, in the depths, when you go under the surface, it's there. And it's there four times. Let me show you. I just love this. This is amazing. In chapter 1, verse 20, we read, so when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. Now, the phrase, it and all wives shall give, is he v'kol hanashim yitnu. And if you take the first letter of each of those words, it spells the name Yud Hey, Vav, Hey, but it's backwards because Hebrew reads from right to left, right? So it's Hey, Vav, Hey, Yud. So at the initial letter of each of these words, we see God's name spelled out, but it's backwards. So what we're going to do is we're going to put an arrow this way because it's backwards. I'll just put back, right? But then later we come to chapter 5, verse 4. And chapter 5, verse 4 says, and Esther said, if it please the king, let the king and Haman come today to a feast that I have prepared for the king. So the phrase, let come the king and Haman today, Yavoa HaMelech V'Haman, there's Haman's name, Hayom. Now here we see the first letter of each word to spell God's name, but this time it's forward. Yud, He, Vav, He. All right, everybody with me? So these two verses, chapter 1, verse 20, chapter 5, verse 4, where God's name appears, the initial letters, and forwards and backwards. Here, it's the first letters where it happens. But then now in chapter 5, verse 13, it says, yet all this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. The phrase, "this avails nothing to me," ze enenu shoer li, it's actually shoer li. Here again, we see God's name spelled out, but it's backwards again. But this time it's the last letters of the four words. Last letters. And then in chapter 7, verse 7, it reads, "And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace guard, but Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm is determined against him by the king." That harm or that evil is determined against him is ki kota eloiv hara'ah. And here we see the last letters, this time going forward. So we have, and these are the only places where you find a grouping of four words where the initial letters or the last letters in order spell God's name. Once backwards, first letters, once forward, using the first letters. Once backwards, using the final letters, once forward, using the final letters. There are no other combinations. But what's really interesting about this, too, is that whenever the name is spelled out backwards, you have a Gentile speaking. Whenever it's spelled forward, you have a Jew speaking. In chapter 1, verse 20, it's spelled backwards because it's a Mimukan, one of the king's servants, speaking. But in chapter 5, verse 4, it's Esther herself who is speaking. So this time, we have a Jew speaking, and now God's name is spelled forwards. Yud, He, Vav, He. And then in chapter 5, verse 13, it's Haman himself speaking, so it's very backwards. And he says, "This avails nothing to me." But then at the end, we have the author of the book of Esther, whether that was Mordecai or one of the other Jewish people at the time, but the author, of course, was Jewish, and this time God's name is spelled forward. Now, there are no other groups of four words where the initial letters or the last letters spell out God's name, either forward or backward. Just these four. Yet you've got one of each. And the forward ones are always spoken by a Jew, but the backward ones are spoken by Gentiles. In one case, the villain Haman himself, in chapter 5, verse 13. So God's name is there, but it's in the details. It's under the surface of the story, undergirding the story. Because you can read the book of Esther and never see his name mentioned. But if you have eyes to see, he's all through this book. Setting up the solution before the problem comes. Establishing the salvation before the villain, the destroyer, comes on the scene. And there's another thing in here that where God's ways are hidden that I just love. In Esther chapter 2, verse 5, we see Mordecai introduced, and it tells us about his lineage. It says, "Now there was a Jew in Shushan," or Shushan, "the capital, whose name was Mordecai." Okay, I mean, you booted Haman. You're supposed to cheer for Mordecai, right? Okay. "The son of Yair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite." Now, what's interesting about this is the Talmud addresses this verse, Esther 2:5, and listen to what it says. This is in Tractate Monachos, page 64b. Mordecai, quote, "brightened the eyes of Israel through his prayers. He was a son to whose prayers God listened. He knocked at the gates of mercy, and they were opened for him." That's based on this verse. You're thinking, how in the world did they get those wonderful words about Mordecai from this verse? This is one of those verses you guys skip over and says, it has nothing to say to me. It's just on that dry lineage. But let me read it again. "Mordecai brightened the eyes of Israel through his prayers. He was a son to whose prayers God listened. He knocked at the gates of mercy, and they were opened for him." The Vilna Gaon, the great genius of Vilna, probably one of the most brilliant men who ever lived in history, explains that Mordecai used all the different forms and powers of prayer to beseech Hashem, you know, Adonai, the name, for salvation. Therefore, when the Megillah lists his ancestry, it refers to names that express his different powers of prayer. The words of "the son of" can mean "derived from," So when you go back, the Vilna Gaon is saying that Mordecai, he was derived from Yair and from Shimei and Kish. Just hold that thought for a moment. Or brought about through. Mordecai's powers came through his prayers. Mordecai invested all his strength in prayer. How do they get that from all that verse? Well, you see, when you look at the three names there, Yair comes from a verb root, hey, aleph resh, just means to light up, to enlighten, to brighten up. Shimei, so we get the word Shema, hear. Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel, to hear. Kish is hey, kof, shin, is the root, which means to knock. What does that remind you of? What does Yeshua say? In Matthew 7:7, he says, ask, it'll be given to you. If to ask, you must be able to hear. God has to hear, you have to hear his answer. And then Messiah goes on and says, seek, and you will find. To seek something, you have to have light. And ha'er, hey, aleph resh, contains the roots for the word or, light, where we get the word aura. And then, kish is the word to knock. There are the three things that Yeshua refers to as being the three-legged stool of prayer. Who would ever have guessed that that was hidden there in the names of Mordecai's ancestors? There's the verse. Now, there was a Jew in Shushan, the capital whose name was Mordecai, the son of light, son of hearing, the son of knocking. Isn't it amazing? Esther is just a great book, isn't it? Now, one of the key verses, if you ask most people, what is the favorite verse from Esther? What is your favorite verse? Many people will look to Esther 4:14, where Mordecai is encouraging Esther to go before the king. You have to go before him. You risk your life, you go into the throne room and approach him. And Esther was very hesitant because she could lose her life, but she agrees to do it. But here's Mordecai's advice: for if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place. In other words, Mordecai is saying, listen, Esther, God has made a covenant with his people to preserve them. He promised Abraham he would preserve his seed. So we know we're going to be spared. We know we're going to come through this. The question is, will we come through it with your help or without your help? What is your part going to be in this? God's going to win. There's no question about that. The question is, will you cooperate with what he's doing, or will you resist it out of fear? So, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you've not come to the kingdom for such a time as this. As I was looking at this, I was thinking of several conversations I've had with people over the last couple of weeks, talking about faith and trust. The Bible uses specific terms for faith and for trust. We tend to think they're the same thing, and they are similar. But the word faith in Hebrew is the word amunah. It starts with the letter aleph, which is the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet, amunah. So we get the word amen. And amunah means you have faith that God is all-powerful, he is sovereign, he can do anything. But you know you can have faith in God and not trust him? A great example of this is Naomi in the first chapter of Ruth. You know the story of Ruth. It's one of the other Megillot. And in the first chapter, Ruth, her husband, and their two grown sons, they leave Bethlehem. There's a famine going on, and they go down the hill and across the river and go into Moab. You know, the last time we were in Bethlehem just a couple years ago, it was a very clear day, and we were up there where the caves are, where the shepherds kept their sheep by night. And it's way up on a hill, And when you stand there on a clear day, you can look down, you can see the Dead Sea, and around the other side, you can see Moab. Which to me was, it never struck me how close it was. And so Naomi and her husband and their two sons, they leave Bethlehem, they go across over the land of Moab. And there, the two sons take wives. One of the wives is Ruth. And while they're there, Naomi's husband dies. Both of her sons die. So here she is with her two daughters-in-law. And Naomi, which means pleasant, she isn't feeling so pleasant anymore. So she tries to talk her daughters-in-law, just stay here, find new husbands, I'm going back home. But Ruth refuses to leave her. There's something still in Naomi, even though her trust in God had weakened. There was something about her that Ruth saw. She says, I'll never leave you. Don't make me turn back, you know. And your people be my people. Your God will be my God. So Ruth and Naomi, they go back to Bethlehem. When she comes back to Bethlehem, the people greet her. And in chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, when the people greet her and excited to see her, you know, welcome back, Naomi. She said to them, do not call me Naomi, pleasant. Call me Mara, bitter. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and Adonai has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi, when Adonai has testified against me, and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me? You might think, oh, Naomi didn't have great faith. Oh, she had tremendous faith. She attributes everything happened in her life to God. Incredible faith. Every single thing that happened, God made happen. She had an amazing faith. What she lacked in God was bitakon or bitakon. It could be pronounced either way, which is trust. Bitakon, trust, begins with the second letter of the alphabet, the letter bet. These two letters together spell the word Av, Father. And you see, you can have tremendous faith in God that he can do all things, but you don't have trust in him that he actually loves you and he'll do it for you. And that's the difference. And you have to have both. One of these without the other, you don't have an experience of God as your Father. You see, if you just believe God has all power, but he doesn't really care about you, you have great faith, no trust. Well, that's not a Father. On the other hand, some people believe, oh, God loves me, he just treasures me, we love to spend time together, but I doubt his power. I don't think he can really come through on this one. This is just too big for him. So you have trust but no faith, or very little faith. You still don't experience him as your Father. To experience God as Av, you must have amuna and bitakon, faith and trust. He can do all things. And he'll do them for you. He'll do it for me. You understand? Remember that when we talk about God being eternal, we think out there. He's so big, he's out there. But remember, to be everywhere, he has to also be in and incredibly small as well. Don't think of his omnipresence as being one-directional. For every greatness and bigness of God out there, there has to be a corresponding smallness and tininess in here, to where he animates every cell in your body, every living part of that cell. He knows the hairs on your head. Not even a sparrow dies without God being at its side when it takes its last breath. You understand? So let's make sure we work on our trust as well as our faith. We talk about faith all the time, but we need to bring trust alongside as well. And some of you are strong in trust. Maybe you need to prop up the faith and increase and strengthen that. Okay? And that's the wonderful story of Ruth when you read the book. You see Naomi's faith in God. By the end of the book, she also now has full trust in God. She saw every negative in her life God used for positive. The problem was the solution. And she began to realize the main purpose for all of that pain in Moab was to bring this one woman back to become Boaz's wife and become the grandmother of King David. That's pretty amazing. Okay, Valerie. We're gonna, yes. Well, if I can get to the spelling, Sharon, you're going to have to help me with this. You know, and unlike English, where you've got only one letter that makes a T sound, in Hebrew you've got a couple. I believe it's spelled, is it tav or tet? I think it's tet too. The tacon, I'm going to, there's two sounds in Hebrew as well. I'm going to trust it's that one. So, we're going to go with that. How's that? And I will check it out before I put this on the internet tomorrow morning. Oh, English. Oh, well, why didn't you say so? That's easy. All right. B-I-T-A-C-H-O-N. All right. Yeah, I'm pretty good going from Hebrew to English, but asking me to go from English to Hebrew, I'm a little dodgy on that. You know, one of the things, too, that you ever notice in the scriptures how you see the number 40 all the time? 40 this, 40 that, everything. 40, 40, 40 everywhere around. Rains for 40 days and nights when Noah and his family are in the ark. Israel goes through the wilderness for 40 years. Yeshua is tested in the wilderness for 40 days. And as you go through scriptures, you'll find a lot more 40s. What's behind this? Well, a 40 always represents transition. Transition. It's when you think of 40, just think of the wilderness. Because what started in Egypt with the Passover is completed in the land when they come in and begin to inherit the land and enter this place of fruitfulness. But you can't get from Egypt to the land without going through the transition of the wilderness. So what takes place in the wilderness? Two main things. Well, three. One is we begin to learn God's word. That's where the Torah was given. He could have given it in Egypt. He could have said, get in the land, I'll give you my word. He didn't. He gave it in the wilderness. Another thing that happened is that what was young, those who were 20 years and old when they left Egypt, they had to grow up, and the old had to die away. Now, I'm not talking about old people dying and young people taking their place. I'm talking about the old things in me of Egypt have to die, and the new life in me has to grow up and take its place. And that's a painful transition. Two things that happened like crazy in the wilderness were births and deaths. And that's what this number 40, this transition period, always has. Births, new life, and deaths. And remember, all pain is birth pain. All pain is birth pain. You going through some pain in your life right now? Financially or with issues, with relationships or whatever? I guarantee you that pain is preceding some birth. Something new. Pain won't kill you, all right? But 40 represents this transition period as we grow up and as we mature and come in to our inheritance and begin to experience the fruitful life. So if 40 represents transition, what does 41 represent? We've come through the transition. We've come through the 40, now we're at 41. We've come a step beyond the transition. Well, here's something that's kind of interesting. The first redemption out of Egypt, who were the two people that God used, the key people? Moses and Aaron, Moshe and Aharon. And notice that Moses' name begins with a Mem, and Aharon begins with an Aleph. Mem equals 40, an Aleph equals 1, 41. In fact, here's a little chart to help you out. There's Aleph, which has a value of 1, and then here's the letter Mem, which has a value of 40. The way it goes is the first 10 letters have values of 1 through 10. Then once you get up to letter Kaf, it goes 20, 30, 40, up to 100. And then you get to Resh, and it's 200, 300, 400, to the last letter Tav. All right? And of course, when Yeshua was here, he was preceded by John the Episcopalian, and who came in the spirit of Elijah. And we're told, it's prophesied, that when Messiah returns, he'll be preceded by Eliyahu. Here's Mashiach, which begins with the letter Mem, and Eliyahu, which begins with Aleph. And of course, our story of Esther, who are the two key figures through whom God brought salvation? Mordecai and Esther. Not coincidence. And the initials of their names add up to 41 because God's bringing him through the transition, crossing the Jordan, coming to a place of fruitfulness. And that's what God's shooting for. The whole purpose of 40 is to get us to 41. All right? Life doesn't start at 40. It starts at 41. That's the message of the Scripture. Well, let's see. Now, I put this chart here because I'm going to show you something truly amazing. And some of you have seen this. If you haven't, you're in for a real treat. In Esther, you come to the place where the war takes place, and then Haman's 10 sons are all hanged on the gallows that Haman himself had built for Mordecai. And when you get to the place where it names the sons, the way that the scroll is written changes. Now, this is from a printed edition of Esther, but they still maintained the continuity of how it appears in a scroll. The only difference here is that they've added some vowel marks. All the little dots and dashes around the letters are vowel marks. And so when it gets down here, it's talking about Ha'aved Chamesh, that it gives the first name, the first son, Parshandata. That's right there. And then over here, Va'et basically means and then it's Dalpon. And then you have that is a verse mark, verse 8. Aspata, and it goes right on down, all 10 sons. So let me erase these marks so you don't get confused. The reason I'm showing you this is because there are some anomalies in the way this is written, and it's written this way in every copy of Esther in the world. Every scroll does it this way. And even the printed Hebrew copies of Esther that I have all do the same thing. Let me show you. If we home in on this word, do you notice how this letter is written small? That's the way it's done everywhere. In every copy of Esther. That's the letter Tav. We'll put it out here to the side. And as we go down a little bit further, you'll see another one. You see it right there? Parmashta, the shin, is written small and up above the line. And then as we go on down, in this last word, Vaisata, you see a little tiny Zion. But then you see this big oversized Vav. So we have three little letters and one big one. And that's the way it's written. If you don't write it that way, well, you can still use the book, but it's not done quite right. Oops, wrong tool. So we have a shin, and shin is worth 300. We had a Zion, which is worth 7. And what was the other one? The other little letter? Tav. Right, the Tav. So if we add these up, 400 plus 300 plus Zion, which is 7, it comes up with 707. There was a rabbi who was a Holocaust survivor who began to study this, and rabbis have studied this for thousands of years, literally. But he had a new insight. He thought, what if this is referring to a year? You see, in the Hebrew calendar, this year, 2014, is the year 5774. 5774. Because the Hebrew calendar doesn't count from the time when Yeshua lived. It counts from the beginning of the world, the creation of the world. And if their calculations are correct, this year is 5,774 years since the world was created. And whether that's the right number or not, I don't know. But this is universally accepted on Hebrew calendars. You look at any Hebrew calendar, this year is 5,774. And then in parentheses, I'll put 2014. So he started wondering, this rabbi wondered, well, 707, and many times they'll just put the last three letters, because we should know what millennium we're in, right? I mean, really. We'll say, oh, back in 03, You don't ask somebody, 1703, 1803, 1903, what 03? Yeah, I mean, you kind of know it's going to be 2003. And so they do the same thing. They'll just give the last three numbers. And so the rabbi started wondering, well, is this referring to 1707, 2707, 3707, 4707, 5707? What millennium is it pointing to? So he went to the large Vav, and he thought it must be the sixth millennium because Vav equals six, as we've seen already. So the sixth millennium would mean it'd be 5707, because that would be 770 years into the sixth millennium. And so he thought, well, what happened in 5707? 5707 equals the year 1946. And just let me read you a historical account of what events transpired on that day. Bible students also noted that the numbers 5707 were hidden in the text with the names of Haman's 10 sons. Right? So you got the 10 sons, and all these letters, the Tav, the Shin, the Zion, the Vav, are all hidden inside their names. The Jewish year 5707 translates to 1946 in our calendar. Fast forward in your thinking to 1946, when Hitler's 12 top henchmen were slated to stand trial in Nuremberg. You want to watch a fascinating video. Find a DVD about the Nuremberg trials in Germany after the war was over, and they tried these war criminals. It's fascinating stuff. It was all filmed. It's kind of scratchy black and white film, but it's all filmed and translated. And to watch a video about this is absolutely fascinating. You see all the bad guys there on trial. And then the witnesses are brought forward, the Jewish witnesses of what took place. And they're facing the perpetrators of the Holocaust. So there were 12 top henchmen were slated to stand trial at Nuremberg. Martin Bormann escaped to South America. And Hermann Göring took cyanide the night before he was to be hanged. That left 10 sons of Hitler to be hanged on the gallows on October 16th, 1946. According to Newsweek magazine, October 28th, 1946, the last one to be hanged was Julius Streicher. As he was dragged to the gallows, he cried out, "Purim Fest, 1946. Festival of Purim, Feast of Esther, 1946. And you wonder, was he actually thinking, you know, I'm like one of the 10 sons of Haman, because there's 10 of us being hanged today? Or did God somehow just prompt him to say that? But it's fascinating to me to think that over 2,000 years ago, God foresaw the Holocaust and these 10 wicked men being hanged, just like Haman's 10 sons. And so he coded into the letters what the date would be, the year 5707, the sixth millennium, the 707th year, which would be 1946. Just a fascinating thing to me. Well, we're not done. You know I'm never done. Another interesting insight into the book of Esther. In Leviticus 23:28, it says, "And you shall not do any work on that very day, for it is a day of atonement." It's actually plural in the Hebrew. It's a day of atonements. And it's even better translated, instead of atonement, day of coverings. But we'll just call it day of atonement. "To make atonement for you before Adonai your God." Now in Hebrew, day of atonement is Yom Kippurim. Yom means day. Kippurim means coverings. What does Kippurim sound like? It sounds like Purim, doesn't it? Purim, the Feast of Esther. In fact, this letter right here, the Kaf, this is can be prefixed to any noun. And when you prefix it, it means like. Like. There isn't really a word used for like in Hebrew. They just stick this letter on the front of another word. So if I want to say something is like a table is shulchan, I can say kashulchan, like a table, all right? If someone is like a father, Av is father, Ch'av would mean like a father. You got it? So this could be translated as a yom like Purim. That the Day of Atonement itself is a day like Purim, like the Feast of Esther. And you think, whoa, wait a minute. If there are 2 days on the Hebrew calendar that are totally not alike, it would be Yom Kippur and Purim. Yom Kippur is a day of fasting. Purim is a day of feasting. Yom Kippur is a day where every little detail is lined up and God's name appears over and over and over. In fact, it's the one day on the Hebrew calendar when the high priest would speak aloud God's four-letter name, Yod, Heh, Vav, Heh, however it's pronounced. We don't know how it's pronounced. But he would pronounce it aloud. The only day of the year he's permitted to do so. And yet in the book of Esther, which describes Purim, his name doesn't even appear, except in secret in those four phrases that we looked at earlier. In Yom Kippur, everything is about salvation, about putting away sin, and it's all spelled out in tremendous detail of what God does. It's all holiness. It's all in the temple. It's all so sacred. And yet the book of Esther takes place in a foreign land among a pagan people with a terrible enemy. And you read about drunkenness and partying and really crude behavior you read about in Esther. It doesn't seem like a very holy book. And yet hidden in the name Yom Kippurim, the Day of Atonement, it can also be read and translated as a day like Purim. That's a valid translation of that phrase. And you shall not do any work on that very day, for it is a day like Purim, to make atonement for you. It's almost as if in the one book, God has given us the details of what's going on in the spiritual realm. And then the other book, he's saying, no, this is what it looks like in the world. You don't see God anywhere. But oh, he's busy. He's at work. You know, I'm thinking about faith and trust and about Yom Kippur and Purim and Book of Esther, how God just doesn't seem to be around. Things just happen to work out right by coincidence. You know, and I'm not being facetious here. I'm not using hyperbole, but you can have two individuals sitting on a bench next to each other. They're physically, their bodies are in the same physical realm, sitting on the same physical bench, and yet the two individuals are living in completely different worlds. Again, I'm not using hyperbole. They exist in two completely different worlds. The one person lives only in the physical world according to his animal drives. And so, he doesn't see God, doesn't believe in God. There's no God. Everything is science and chance, and it's just a matter of what are the odds, you know, throw the dice. What's chance, you know? What's the word I'm looking for? What's probability. Everything's just matter of probability. And so his life is divided between worry and fear, anxiety, and indulging his animal appetites. And then worrying some more. And then, you got to have some fun. So he indulges his animal appetites back and forth. And there's misery, just misery. Over here's another person. This person has chosen to believe that there's a God behind the scenes. There is a God who hides himself, but he's very active. A God in whom he has faith and trust. And he sees the world in a completely different way. In fact, the world he experiences is completely different. Where he sees a world where there is light in the darkness, where there is purpose in the chaos, where there is order, even when things look like it's just all probability, that there's a God who runs the world. And so in his life, yeah, there are testings and there are failings, but there's joy, there's purpose, there's a confidence, there's a peace that passes understanding. And though they both operate in the same physical realm, the internal worlds are two different, complete different galaxies. You understand what I'm saying? So I'm going to leave you with just a couple things. You know, Haman looked like he had, like my dad used to say, he had the world in a jug and the stopper in his hand. You know, he looked like he had everything just sewed up and he couldn't lose. But in Ecclesiastes, a long time before the book of Esther was written, Ecclesiastes 2:26, this was written, "For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God." Isn't that interesting? Is that the story of Haman or what? Because Haman had accumulated wealth and prestige. He had his wonderful palace. Guess who got it all when Haman was hanged? It all went to Mordecai. How about Haman's lofty position in the government? Where did it go? Went to Mordecai. Everything Haman worked for and accumulated went to Mordecai. It's a fulfillment of that passage. And last of all, I'll leave you a little story. I just love this. I'm glad we have time. Well, we don't have time for it. Doing it anyway. It says, the verse discusses the lineage of Mordecai. Yeah, that's not the right one. Okay, let me get it. It's worth waiting for. I'm sorry. I grabbed the wrong one out of my notebook. It's a parable about a bird who gets angry at the ocean. The Midrash relates the following parable to describe Haman's attempt to destroy the people of Israel. A bird made its nest on the beach, but a wave came and swept it away. The bird was so angry that it decided to dry out the sea. So it flew to the sea, filled its beak with water, and flew back over the sand, dropping the water on the sand. Then it took some crumbs of sand in its beak and dropped them in the ocean. It continued to do this all day. Its friend asked, "What are you doing?" The bird answered, "I am getting rid of the ocean and that destroyed my nest." The first bird answered, "You fool, you'll never succeed. The only thing certain about what you're doing is that you will suffer a breakdown, not the sea." So too, says the Midrash, the only thing certain about Haman's attempt to destroy the people of Israel is that he'll be destroyed and not them. It is very true words that we are battling an enemy that's already defeated and serving a God who's already won. And just time is just playing out the script. But the end is written already. It's done. And, you know, when we begin to read the book of Esther in this way and see it with these eyes, what do we have to worry about? And you have faith that God did these things for Israel, for Mordecai and Esther. But if you have trust, you realize he does these things, same things for you and me. And that's why it's written here. So we can have trust in God, that he'll take care of us. You're going through pain now? They went through pain. You can imagine the anxiety they went through and the pain of loss that Naomi went through. Boy, by the end of the book, they're all rejoicing. They're all having a party. So go through the pain. It's birth pain. And when it gives birth to this new thing, whatever God is doing in your life, you're going to forget the pain and it's just going to be rejoicing. That's why we have joy. That's why we keep looking forward, moving ahead. Our time is way gone, so we're going to close in prayer. If you have questions or comments, then meet me up here or meet me on Oneg and we'll talk some more. Our Father and King, thank you so much for the blessing of your word. It's so filled to overflowing with goodness. And Father, David said in the Psalms, he said, "Taste and see that the Lord is good." But so often we want to see first before we put anything in our mouths. Father, I pray we would learn to walk in faith and trust, and we will take what you give us, we will put it in our mouths, we will taste it and swallow it, and then our eyes will be opened and we'll see that you truly are good. And the verse goes on to say, "Blessed is the man who takes refuge in the Lord." So, Father, help us to taste and see how good you are and then run to you for our refuge and strength. For you're that kind of God. You are this God in the book of Esther. You're the same God now for each one of us. May we learn the lessons this wonderful book has to teach us. And may our love for you grow as we grow in faith and in trust in you. We'll give you the praise for it. And we thank you for these things in the name of Yeshua. In whose name we pray, amen. Let's stand together, and if you have little ones, you can go gather them up. And Tim, if you come forward, lead us in the blessing.